This is Talk of the Nation. I'm Neil Conan in Washington. Earlier this week, The Washington Post reported on a previously unknown spy unit run not by the CIA, but by the DIA, the Defense Intelligence Agency. Worried that they hadn't been briefed on the matter, several members of Congress cried foul, including Republican Senator John McCain. But the Pentagon maintains that this clandestine operation, the Strategic Support Branch, has been subject to proper congressional review. The controversy comes amid one of the biggest intelligence shakeups in American history. The intelligence reforms passed by Congress late last year have yet to take much effect. President Bush has yet to name a new National Intelligence Director. Meanwhile, CIA Director Porter Goss has made a lot of changes at the CIA, a purge or a house cleaning, depending on your point of view. We'll bring you up to date on what's been happening, and then focus on the role of secrecy. We'll talk with William Arkin, author of the new book, Codes, and with a former deputy CIA director, Richard Kerr. Later in the program, the Senate debates the nomination of Condoleezza Rice to be Secretary of State, and we'll talk with Robert Krulwich. His new program, Nova Science Now, debuts tonight on PBS. But first, intelligence in transition. If you have questions about what's happened thus far and what happens next, our number here in Washington is 800-989-8255. That's 800-989-TALK. The email address is TOTN at NPR.org. And joining us now is NPR security reporter Mary Louise Kelly. She joins us in Studio 3A. Thanks very much for being with us.
Hi, Neil. Glad to be here.
Intelligence reform was passed late in December. What movement have we seen thus far as a result?
There has been some movement. One of the major reforms of that bill, as you'll recall, was creating a new national counterterrorist center. That center has been created. It's up and running. It has a new boss named John Brennan, and they've got offices in Northern Virginia where they are starting work. So there has been some concrete progress. Congress has made a few admittedly modest reforms, created a few new subcommittees, extended term limits for the members of the intelligence committees. Certainly nothing like the sweeping overhaul of congressional oversight that the 9/11 commission had called for. But the major reform that everyone is still waiting for is, as you mentioned, that we still don't have a director of national intelligence, and a lot will fall from that. Many people that I speak to, both on the Hill, at the CIA, and other quarters, say we're just waiting to see who this person is, and we'll get a real sense from that in terms of what kind of battles they're going to be willing to take on with the CIA, with the Defense Department, with other agencies, and see from there how a lot of this will shake out.
Any floated ideas as to who might that intelligence director be?
Well, there's still a lot of names circulating, rumors swirling about this. I will say my sources have been even more tight-lipped than usual on this. I think, given the embarrassment over Bernard Kerik...
At Homeland Security.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Another prominent nominee whose nomination crashed and burned spectacularly in December. I think they're being very, very careful to vet this carefully and to not leak names. Some of the names that you do hear being circulated as potentially very strong candidates would be the current head of the National Security Agency, that's General Michael Hayden, over at NSA. You hear a couple of the names that perpetually float around on this. Former Senator Sam Nunn, for example. John Lehman, one of the 9/11 commissioners, who, of course, has a strong military background. And some former CIA directors you hear names being kicked around. Robert Gates, for example, who ran the CIA back in the early 90s. So those are some of the names out there. And then, of course, the big name still dangling is Porter Goss, who was the president's choice as director of Central Intelligence. He's confirmed. He's now running the CIA. The thinking was for a long time that the job of this new intelligence chief was his if he wanted it. However, given, as you alluded to, a lot of the turmoil and controversy at the CIA late last year, there are now, I think, real questions about whether he would be confirmable at yet a higher position. And so you hear his name mentioned perhaps a bit less often.
He would have to undergo a second confirmation process in the United States Senate for this grander role, perhaps even to stay on as CIA chief, though that's unclear. But certainly if he were to be named the new National Intelligence Director, and as you said, he's made some enemies.
Different job, so he would have to be confirmed again. And what has happened at the CIA, I think, has reinforced some of the questions that some of the Democratic senators had about him.
Well, what kind of changes has he been making, and what purpose have you been able to detect behind those changes?
That is still the big question, is what his grand strategic vision for the CIA is. There was, of course, a month or two ago at the CIA, a tremendous amount of turmoil. Many senior officials either being pushed out or fired or walking out of their own accord. Tremendous upheaval in the clandestine service, the part of the CIA that actually manages spies and does spying themselves. Almost all of the senior leadership either quit or walked out, or was asked to leave in the clandestine service. Other changes throughout the agency. That has now quieted down a bit. The CIA is not in the headlines every single day anymore, which from their point of view is a good thing. But my sources there describe it to me as the situation being a truce, but an uneasy truce.
Are these people being blamed for the errors that led the errors of intelligence before 9/11 and before in the run-up to the war in Iraq? Are they being ousted for any administrative sins that we may not know about? Are they being ousted because they were part of the old guard? What's going on?
I think there are a number of things at play here. Porter Goss was very clear and in his confirmation hearing said, I think the agency needs a shake-up, and that is what I would do. We need to become much more aggressive, much less risk averse, and we need to make some changes. So I think the President Bush made clear that he wanted to see changes at the CIA. He sent Porter Goss in to do it. He's doing it. Now, there are those who would say that the people who have actually left are not those who should be held accountable. Some of them were quite senior officials from George Tenet's tenure at the CIA. Others are people who had actually been rising through the ranks and were, you know, just taking over new jobs. The people who were running the clandestine service who left under Mr. Goss had actually only just been installed in those jobs for a matter of months. So there are a number of things at play here, and I think, you know, what remains to be seen is as you say, what the grand guiding vision here is. Mr. Goss, the only thing that he's really alluded to is that he wants to see much more aggressive intelligence gathering operations, much more aggressive human intelligence, spies on the ground. But in terms of how that will happen and how these personnel changes are a part of that, that's apparently not been made clear to people at the agency who are still waiting to hear what's his plan.
Mm-hmm. Let's shift gears just a little bit and talk about the Post report that emerged this week about the Pentagon's clandestine spy unit. What do we know about the Strategic Support Branch?
Well, I think that the idea here is that the Defense Department has wanted to and has set up its own secret intelligence teams that will work alongside military forces on counterterrorist missions. We should say the Defense Department has for a long time done its own spying, had its own human intelligence teams. It has its own Defense Intelligence Agency, as you've mentioned. What's different here is that it has formed teams, small teams, I'm told about 10 members, who would actually go out with special operations forces, and that is a new thing. The controversy here is over whether they have the authority to do this, whether they are stepping too much on the CIA's turf. You get into definitional questions here, and one of the questions is whether what they are doing is clandestine action or covert action. Those covert implies has a legal definition, which is that Congress has to be notified of a covert action, the President and the White House actually have to sign off on it, issue a directive supporting it, and, key thing, the U.S. government will deny any knowledge of it, that it was ever involved. That's what a covert action is. Right now, most lawyers think that only the CIA is authorized to carry out covert actions, and so if the Defense Department is going down that road, that raises some problems, and that is what has got people on Capitol Hill, as you mentioned, upset.
Mm-hmm. Now, you can certainly see a distinction between these defense teams that are trying to find out what's happening over the next hill and is the enemy maneuvering to come and get, and CIA, which is trying to find out where the missile is going to be launched from.
Right.
Yet you can also see a lot of places where these two could overlap. You could end up with two different agencies trying to hire the same spies or their operations
recruit the same sources.
Yeah,
right.
All these things. There's a lot of potential overlap here. Are people concerned about that?
I think there is concern about that. You obviously don't want duplication of efforts. You know, to the extent that this has been aired publicly and we've heard what the top people at these departments say, there were hearings on Capitol Hill as the intelligence reform legislation was going through. And last August, Donald Rumsfeld, Secretary of Defense, and John McLaughlin, who at that time was the acting director of the CIA, testified. They both came out and said, we think things work okay as they are, that the CIA has special skills and is able to be quick and nimble in a way that the Pentagon and defense forces are not, that the Defense Department and with its own intelligence teams has a lot more firepower at its command. So they were arguing this should stay separate. But we will see. There is a deadline of mid-February when both the Defense Department and the CIA have been tasked with reporting back to the president on how they think paramilitary operations should be carried out in future. So that'll be interesting to see what they come up with. And then, of course, there's what gets done that's not officially laid out, and that is at the heart of this debate as well.
Let's see if we can get a caller involved in this conversation. Bob joins us from Cedar Rapids, Iowa.
Yes, I'm curious to know if clandestine military officers, presumably not in uniform, were captured by a, quote, enemy, would they be considered by that enemy under conventional Geneva Conventions prisoners of war and subject to that treatment, or would they be considered in some other manner?
As spies, presuming the enemy has signed the Geneva Accords. Mary Louise.
Right. It's an interesting question, and I'll be completely honest and say I don't know the answer to that. I think, you know, lawyers that you talk to say that a lot of what is governing this is the U.S. Code, which governs military operations and the armed forces. There is also, you know, by definition, a lot of what the CIA does is illegal. They are operating in foreign countries, you know, without strictly adhering to those countries' laws. So I think these are important questions, and I don't know that we have all of the legal answers on that right now. There are different interpretations of how you can read the law governing this and what these forces' authorities are versus what their known capabilities are.
Thanks for the call, Bob. Important question.
Thank you.
Mary Louise, thanks to you as well. We thank you for your time, as always.
My pleasure.
NPR intelligence correspondent Mary Louise Kelly here with us in Studio 3A. We're going to take a short break. When we return, William Arkin will join us to talk about the role that secrecy plays in the post-9/11 era and the degree to which it can either contribute or take away from our national security. How much do we need to know and share about intelligence and military operations? 800-989-8255, TOTN at NPR.org. I'm Neil Conan. It's Talk of the Nation from NPR News. This is Talk of the Nation. I'm Neil Conan in Washington. We're discussing intelligence reform and the role of secrecy in the CIA and other branches of American intelligence, and of course at the Pentagon as well. We want to hear from you. Where do you draw the line between the need for secrecy and the need for oversight and communication in the war on terror? Our phone number is 800-989-8255. That's 800-989-TALK, the email address, TOTN, at NPR.org. The proposed changes spelled out in the Intelligence Reform Bill raise questions about the role and effectiveness of secrecy. In his new book, Codenames, Deciphering U.S. Military Plans, Programs, and Operations in the 9/11 World, military analyst William Arkin attempts to shed some light on the secrecy within the government's clandestine operations. Bill Arkin joins us now from the studios at MSNBC in Secaucus, New Jersey. Thanks very much for being on the program.
Thank you very much for having me.
Your book, I think we should probably describe it. There was a lot of publicity on Sunday in some of the papers, but your book is it's really about secrecy, isn't it?
Well, it is, in fact, action against secrecy, which is to say that I'm a longstanding military analyst. I've kind of collected these code names and tried to understand the scope and breadth and activities of the American military for over 20 years. And it seemed to me that there was a marked increase in secrecy since 9/11. And rather than just complain about it, I was sort of in a position to write about it in a way that may be even useful, which is to put together as much as I can what I call a DNA map of the U.S. military and the U.S. intelligence establishment, making the argument that much of this secrecy is trivial and that certainly even the secrecy that is more serious can have a terribly detrimental impact on U.S. foreign policy and on the American public.
Well, let's talk, for example, one amongst very many, and people have picked out one and talked about. Well, let's pick out one called West Wing, which is not a popular television show. Well, it is a popular television show, but it is also describes two U.S. bases in Jordan.
Well, during the Iraq War, the United States prepared a Western front to bring special operations forces into Western Iraq, to interpose itself between Iraq and Israel to ensure that Israel didn't intervene during the war. And Jordan consented to the United States placing its military forces and air forces on Jordanian soil under the conditions that those deployments would be secret. They were then therefore given a code name, West Wing. And basically then, and this was reported in the news media, mm-hmm. by the way, the Jordanian government denied that there were any American forces on the ground in Jordan, even at the moment that the U.S. was deploying Patriot surface-to-air missiles in Amman, in the capital, in the open, where everyone could see them. So we were basically manufacturing secrets on behalf of the Jordanian government. And had something gone wrong in Jordan, and the American people then learned about it only after the event, I guess a lot of people would have been very surprised to know that we consented to creation of secret bases merely because the Jordanian government didn't want to be accountable to its own people.
But maybe if the deal was those bases had to be public, the Jordanian government would have said, well, no thanks then.
Well, and that is one of the problems of working in the open. Yet at the same time, in the type of world that we live in, I make the argument in this book that when secrets are known by our enemies, which is to say that they're known by the terrorist organizations or known by those on the ground and not known by the American people, then we do suffer the consequences of that. Similarly, I focus, for instance, in this book on U.S. bases in Pakistan, mm-hmm. and the fact that the U.S. military has developed a capability in Pakistan since 9/11. Now, the U.S. has forces deployed on the ground in Pakistan today. In fact, we may maintain a major air base there. And were that base to be attacked by terrorists or were a U.S. soldier to be captured or kidnapped tomorrow, it would come as a major surprise to most people that the U.S. military was there. But for the very reason that, again, the Pakistani government wants to cooperate with the United States on the one hand, but yet on the other hand, it also doesn't want to admit its cooperation. And the United States gets embroiled in that kind of world. I think that the message that it sends is that essentially states say one thing and do another. That the United States as a country says one thing, that it believes in truth and it believes in liberty and openness, but yet when it comes to its actual actions, it does another thing. And I spent a lot of time in Iraq during the Saddam Hussein era, and that's one of the things I always heard from the Iraqi government was that, oh, well, the United States, you know, it says one thing, but it does another. It cooperated with us during the Iran-Iraq war when we were developing and using chemical weapons, and it never said anything to us about it during this whole period of time. And so I think the lesson that the Iraqis learned from this, if you will, if they learn anything, is that this is the way that the world works. And I think that in the world that we live in the confused state of people being recruited in terrorist organizations where they think that they can take the law into their own hands, one of the things that is the reality is that people believe that the world doesn't function as a world of laws. It doesn't function as a world of rules. And that is what spawns and that is what creates the networks of terrorism that exist today.
Let's get a listener involved in the conversation. And Chad is with us from Virginia Beach.
Hello.
Hi.
Yeah, I'm an intelligence officer in the military. I've been following the discussion in the press pretty avidly, as you can imagine.
Mm-hmm.
And I think there is a very fine line that you have to hold to in terms of what kinds of things are kept secret and what aren't. You know, the American people certainly have a right to know, you know, what is going on with you know, the forces that are out there protecting us. But at the same time, you know, there's large amounts of information that are protected for good reason because there are people out there whose lives are being put at risk every day. And not just classified information, but when you talk about something like operational security, where there's large bits of unclassified information that when you put it together, you can start putting pieces together about what the military wants to do. Classic example is, you know, the Pentagon orders a whole bunch of pizzas one night, something must be up. But, you know, I guess I get very concerned when we start discussing this, because as you start releasing little bits and pieces, as those pieces start adding up, you really do start putting lives at risk, and ultimately that's, on the military side, what we're trying to protect.
Bill Arkin?
Well, I do think that there's legitimate secrecy, and I was very careful in preparing this book to ensure that I wasn't compromising any sources or methods of intelligence or compromising ongoing operations with details that might, in fact, put people at risk. So I agree with the caller that there is, in fact, legitimate secrecy and that there is a line to be drawn. I also think that the caller would probably agree with me that the military overclassifies too much material, that there's too much trivial secrecy, that secrecy is growing under this administration, even by the General Services Administration's own accounting, there was something on the order of a 25% increase in classification actions within the U.S. government in the year 2003, the last year for which we have data. And the United States spends about $7.5 billion a year in administering the secrecy system. So everyone has lamented the fact that there's too much secrecy. The 9/11 Commission, of course, focused a lot of attention, our attention, on the fact of the failure of agencies to communicate with each other because of compartmentalization and secrecy. The fact that bureaucracies tend to hoard information for power. And we are told, on the one hand, that everything has changed post 9/11, and yet at the same time we've seen an increase in administrative secrecy and security under this administration. So while on the one hand I think it is important for the military and the intelligence community to protect the legitimate secrets, at the same time I think what happens is so much is secret and so much is trivially secret that we suffer as a result of that, and the real secrets, of course, don't get really protected because they get swallowed up in this Niagara and this tsunami of government secrecy.
Chad, thank you.
Thank you.
Joining us now is Richard Kerr, a former deputy director of the Central Intelligence Agency. He's with us by phone from his home in Kitty Hawk, North Carolina, and it's very good of you to take the time to be with us today.
Yeah, my pleasure.
You've dealt with a lot of these issues throughout your career. Where do you draw the line between secrets that must be kept and those that really shouldn't?
Well, I was listening to Mr. Arkin, and I sympathize to a considerable degree with much of what he says, although as someone who's been primarily on the analytic side of this, I spent most of my career working on putting together small pieces of information to arrive at judgments about activities. So I've looked at it from the other perspective, and that is how people look at information, gather it together, draw conclusions out of it, and make sense out of it. And unless you have secrecy around those things, and it's not always the obvious things that need to be protected. Unless you have some secrecy around those, others can use that information against you rather well.
Does it concern you that some things may have been published by inadvertently and thinking in all good faith that they weren't going to endanger anything, and somebody somewhere working on something can put that together with three other things and say, aha?
Well, there's no questions. In 32 years at working on intelligence, I've seen many instances when a small release of information has caused the source of that information to dry up and go away forever, and at sometimes at very significant loss.
Mm-hmm. Bill Arkin, did you consider that as you were going through the material that you put in this book?
Well, I did, and in sympathy to Dick Kerr, I would say the following. In his 32 years in intelligence, as it has matched my 30 years both being in the military and then as a civilian analyst, I would guess that most of the times when there has been a significant loss of secrecy in the U.S., it's been because agents from the inside of the CIA or the FBI have sold secrets to the bad guys. That's really where the significant compromises have taken place. The compromises that have actually taken place as a result of books or press articles pale in comparison to that. So, again, I think we can have an ephemeral discussion about secrecy and its impact, positive and negative, but I felt that that given the enormous growth of secrecy that has taken place in the last decade, and particularly since 9/11, that it was important to do something about it. And I think I demonstrate in this book, through cataloging 3,000 different code words of the U.S. government, that in fact most of this is not really important secrets. Most of this is trivial secrets, and that the real secrets of the CIA and the NSA and the FBI, in fact, remain secret because I certainly couldn't find them out, nor could other members of the press. So whether the government does a competent job in safeguarding its secrets from our enemies is an interesting question, but I don't think that the media or scholars are the primary threats to the sanctity of government information. It is internal spies who are really the threats.
We're speaking with William Arkin. His new book is Codenames, Deciphering U.S. Military Plans, Programs, and Operations in the 9/11 World. Also with us is former Deputy CIA Director Richard Kerr. And this is all coming to you over Talk of the Nation from NPR News. And let's get another caller in on the conversation. This is John. John's with us from Fort Bragg, North Carolina.
Hello, Neil.
Yes, go ahead, John.
Yeah, hey, look, I just wanted to offer some anecdotal information and get into the argument versus the CIA and the DOD. I think a lot of what goes on in the world of intelligence needs to be moved over to the DOD as opposed to the CIA. Good example would have been earlier when we had the big hubbub about the uranium and it compromised the guy's wife who was an ambassador there.
Mm-hmm.
If this would have been within the purview of the DOD, I think that would have been a lot less likely to occur.
Well, the whole plame controversy is maybe another issue, but something off the subject, but Richard Kerr, as long as we've got you on the line, this controversy over DIA-led teams as opposed to CIA-led teams.
Well, I think, you know, certainly the Defense Department has a right to, and an obligation to protect its forces on the ground and to collect information. It's always had that responsibility to protect its installations and its people and its operations. I guess I would raise some serious questions, however, about running operations where the information is not where the information collected by DOD is not systematically disseminated to the other people involved in the intelligence business. One of the complaints of DIA of defense over years has been we don't get all the information. But in fact, the CIA has a rather impressive dissemination system for its clandestine reporting to people who need it. It's not clear to me that under the defense has a similar reporting system that will allow that information that it would consider tactical to get back into the system. And, you know, part of the problem is sharing this complexity of information and tactical information and strategic information. A little hard to sort those two things out now.
Mm-hmm.
I would say one thing here. I think the CIA is good at the operational or strategic level collecting information, but if you're going to talk about tactical information collecting and dissemination, I think the DOD is hands down the winner on that.
Well, that's its job. Sure, I don't disagree with that. I mean, I think that its job is to do tactical information, but it will do tactical information at the expense of longer-term significant problems, and it will, in some cases, not collect against those problems because of the need to do the short-term tactical intelligence.
Mm-hmm. Bill Arkin, again, with your analyst hat on, do you see the potential for conflict here, or stepping on toes at the very least?
Well, I really think that the issue of what the military calls deconflicting CIA and DOD operations is not really one of great concern. I'm not particularly concerned that the agency and the Pentagon trip over each other. I think that, in fact, the lines of communications and the liaison between those agencies has really been improved since 9/11. There is a concern that Donald Rumsfeld, Secretary of Defense, has a tendency to reach into his hip pocket and create ad hoc organizations when he's not happy that the bureaucracy is not moving fast enough for him.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that that's a little bit of what we see here. Of course, when the Congress people asked about the Washington Post article on Sunday and Monday, what they were told was, you know, you forgot that we had briefed you about this, and you forgot that it was in the budget and you had already approved it, which I accept. My sources tell me is true. But what we do have at the same time is an enormous growth of clandestine operations on the part of the American military that are not tactical related. When the caller says tactical, it it conjures up an image of the battlefield. It conjures up the war in Iraq. But in fact, a lot of military activity is taking place outside of Iraq and outside of Afghanistan, and it is more on the so-called strategic level. And when the military becomes more involved in a strategic intelligence and strategic offensive operations in the war on terrorism, then there are issues associated with Geneva Convention and international law and the propriety of the military doing this as opposed to the CIA. So I'm not so concerned that the Congress hasn't been adequately informed. I'm concerned about the wisdom of the military playing a broader and broader role. By the way, that was one of the major recommendations of the 9/11 Commission, which was to put the military in charge of all this. I think that would be a mistake.
John, thank you very much for the call. We appreciate it. Richard Kerr, thank you for your time today. Appreciate it.
My pleasure.
Richard Kerr, former Deputy Director of the CIA, and Bill Arkin, as always, thank you for joining us.
Thank you very much.
His new book is Code Names, Deciphering U.S. Military Plans, Programs, and Operations in the 9/11 World. When we come back, the Senate debates Condoleezza Rice's nomination. It's Talk of the Nation from NPR News.